hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Andrew Skousen. And Andrew is part of the staff at the World Affairs Brief, a fascinating website. And of course, they have information there that every one of you should be going over every day as they pick out the articles from the Asia Times and the India Times and Reuters and BBC and certainly from the American publications as well, to give you an overview of what's really going on behind the scenes, the information you're not going to get from the controlled media here in the United States. And so without further ado, hi, Andrew. How are you tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us again. And so what are we going to talk about this evening?
Well, there's actually quite a few major stories that are breaking. I'd like to talk about the generals who are criticizing Rumsfeld. I'd also like to talk about Iran and what's going on there. If we have a chance, we can touch on Italy and the leftist comeback there, as well as possibly fit in an election forecast of what's going to happen in 2008. Which topic would you like to cover first?
Those are all important issues.
Yeah, I'll say. Let's start with the generals' criticism of Rumsfeld. I think that this is a hot topic with all of the news agencies now, and if we provide people with some insight into this, then they'll know how to watch what's happening here. The recent effects of this are that several of the high-ranking retired generals and officers in the military, several of which have served in Iraq under Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, have publicly called for his resignation. These include the most recent Marine Lieutenant General Greg Newbold, who joined General Paul D. Eaton, who actually commanded the training of Iraqi security forces, and General Anthony Zinni, who is a four-star Marine general who also had vast experience in the Middle East. Anthony Zinni, in fact, was Bush's Israeli-Palestinian negotiator for a while. So several people with significant background in Iraq are turning against President Rumsfeld now and calling for his resignation. In fact, David Ignatius of the Washington Post gave a sense of how widespread the criticism is of Rumsfeld when he reported that an army officer with extensive Iraqi combat experience thought that of the number of colleagues who wanted Rumsfeld out totaled almost 75% of the servicemen.
And these are the officer corps. These are the generals who are actually appalled, right. But they couldn't give their names after all. If they came forward, why, they would certainly be drummed out of the military. But off the record, these people would tell you that Donald Rumsfeld has made a terrible mess of things over there. He's overridden his commanders at every term. He sent in inadequate men. He blocked the training of the Iraqi army, which is, of course, why Major General Paul Eaton came out against them. We'll cover all of these things when we get back here at Radio Liberty. Go ahead, Andrew. Pick the story up there.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the effect that going to war with Iraq is incurring. Because most of the military leaders at the time that we were going to war with Iraq were of the opinion that the war in Iraq was unnecessary, unwise, that it was predicated on false assumptions, and on top of that, they are coming to realize that it is incompetently managed.
And I think, of course, General Zinni had made the public statement, look, why didn't we get Osama bin Laden? Why didn't we finish the war on terror? Why did we go to Iraq? They were no danger to us. And he made that statement actually on 60 Minutes, and it's covered in one of my newsletters. But why didn't we get Osama bin Laden? And I think I keep asking that question. Why did President George Bush, first of all, allow the CIA to allow bin Laden to escape from the Tora Bora Mountains, and then when he moved into Pakistan, why didn't they go after him? Do you think for one minute that really wanted to get him, the fact that Pakistan, was a sovereign nation, would influence them at all? They're going to send in special forces units, just like they're sending special forces units and other units into Iran at the present time. Certainly, if they wanted to get Osama bin Laden, they could have, and they didn't. And I think General Zinni's asking, why did we go to war with Iraq? When we really went into Afghanistan to get al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and we didn't do it, and we didn't try to finish the job.
Exactly. And that brings up a very important point, which is that all of these generals' criticisms of Rumsfeld is an indication that what the military is doing in Iraq does not follow the standard logical procedure steps of encouraging Iraqi freedom and taking weapons of mass destruction away from these countries. What these military personnel are seeing firsthand as they implement the desires of these globalist leaders is that they don't follow what they're saying out in the news, and they consistently get frustrated with it, and it creates a lot of antagonism among the people that have to carry out the orders of the globalists, which are not moral things, and increasingly it creates discomfort and hatred among these, and that is what we are seeing with these generals and their discontent with Rumsfeld, who is the principal.
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andrew is talking about the fact that a number of generals have come forward now, I think either five or six, and they've just said that Rumsfeld should be forced to resign. He should be removed from office. Major General Paul Eaton was in Iraq. He was assigned the task of rebuilding the Iraqi army, and we cover his story in my, I believe, my February newsletter. Major General Paul Eaton was to build an army for a nation of 25 million people. He was assigned six people to help him. They promised him 250, but he never got them. He got a few officers who were there for 3 months or 6 months, and then they went on. He was not allowed to call back any of the Iraqi military people. There were units he could have gotten non-commissioned officers out of. So he had nobody to train the Iraqi army. And every time he tried to do what was wrong, was right, he was blocked by the Pentagon, by Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon. So it was quite obvious that they were not trying to rebuild the Iraqi army or a successful one. They wanted to keep the American troops there. Furthermore, when George Bush, the first, George Herbert Walker Bush, attacked Kuwait in the 1991, and all he had to do was going to shoo the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, he sent in 695,000 men. And yet, supposedly, we're going to get involved in a guerrilla war in Baghdad and Basra and all these other cities, with 160,000 men. What sort of madness is this? I think that's what the military is upset about, don't you, Andrew?
That is definitely one large aspect. And I think what you pointed out, how people who are actually attempting to implement appropriate measures to keep civil war from happening in Iraq and to put down these conflicts that are starting to pop up and continue to be exacerbated are stymied and aren't given the help that they need, and this leads and adds to the conflict that is going on. It's interesting that you brought up the number of about almost 700,000 troops who were put to send the Iraqis out of Kuwait clear back in 1992, and now they have just under, or you know, just barely 160,000 men to control the entire country. It
really doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it only makes sense if they want to keep the number of the soldiers there low enough to allow the civil war and the aggression between the political groups there to foment and to grow and to create conflict there, which will further require that the military stay there, that we remain in control over Iraq and keep the country in U.S. hands.
Well, I don't know why anybody should be surprised if we want to continue to occupy Iraq. I mean, we're still occupying Germany 60 years after the Second World War, Japan 60 years after the Second World War, South Korea 50 years after that war ended. We intend to keep our troops permanently stationed in Iraq, and that's the reason why we're not really trying to win the war. We provoked the civil war, and then many, many people think that a lot of these bombings, a lot of this killing of the Shias, killing of the Sunnis, is actually being fostered by agent provocateurs who are, in one way or another, being tolerated by the American forces to create the civil war to justify our staying there. I don't know whether that's true or not, but there's a great deal of evidence that we are using agent provocateurs to keep this conflict going.
That's true. That's true. One of the points that I want to make with this story about the generals who are recommending that Rumsfeld resign is that all of these complaints, or almost all of them, have come from retired generals. The reason for this is something that I think needs to be brought to light and brought out into the open, is the atmosphere that the military has against people who speak out against the policies of the military and against the policies of the civilian politicians who run the military. Although it's proper that the military be under civilian control of elected officials, this is not a justification for the implied and even tightly enforced doctrine that the military cannot publicly criticize its civilian leaders when those leaders' policies threaten the good order of the military or the security of our nation, such as what happened or is happening in Iraq and happened most notably in Vietnam. Historically, there have been a couple of great generals, including MacArthur and Patton, who were prominent examples of courage, of speaking out against the civilian politicians' implementation of or their control of what these generals were attempting to do to bring the war that they were involved in to a short end, and in order to advance certain political agendas that were not in the nation's best security. It is our opinion here at the World Affairs Brief, especially that of my father, who served in the military for a time, is that the right to speak out against what one feels morally unacceptable is something that should be enshrined in the military code of conduct. Currently, the Uniform Code of Military Justice does not allow any officer to criticize the commander-in-chief without fear of a court-martial. And I think that this is one of the major reasons why we don't see more people in the military speaking out against Rumsfeld. It only comes from that sector that is retired. Consequently, at the World Affairs Brief, we don't believe that this will cause Rumsfeld to resign. Rumsfeld is, as I was saying earlier, part of the global cabal that is running and enforcing the agendas of the Bush administration, or the agendas that are being put forth through the Bush administration. Bush is mostly a puppet. In our opinion, the control people inside of the Bush administration include Cheney, Rumsfeld, Condi Rice, and Stephen Hadley as the National Security Advisor, and John Bolton, who is the UN ambassador. These five people are, we believe, the principal people that are enforcing the politics and the agendas of the people behind the scenes of the Bush administration. And as we can see, many of the people who are under these five people are increasingly concerned as they see that what they try to implement is not in the country's best interest and is often even contrary to what they say and what the media says that they are trying to do with these policies. And I think that over time we will see more and more discontent kind of creep out from under the carpet from people who are under these people as they see this continue to roll out.
And I think your father made the point, that certainly the five people you mentioned are the people who control George Bush and tell him really, in essence, what to do and manipulate him. But they are simply not at the upper echelon. There are people who are much higher in this. And, of course, pointed to Henry Kissinger, who certainly is one of the major architects of everything going on. But then people have forgotten that Henry Kissinger is simply a mouthpiece or a puppet for the Rockefellers and the occult influences that they represent, because there really are forces working behind the scenes that I believe, of course, are moving us towards world government. And I believe, of course, Iraq is a stepping stone to a war with Iran, which will bring about World War III. They need another world war to bring about their world government. That's what it's really all about. If you understand that all of the people are dying over there, are not dying to bring freedom to America. We're losing our freedom at home while our attention is focused over there. But when World War III comes, of course, I fear that all freedom here at home will be lost.
Very good point. Speaking of Iran, I'd like to move into that topic now. I think that some very interesting recent occurrences have strengthened the U.S.'s position of attempting to attack Iran. Mostly what Iran itself has done. It's very interesting to observe how Iran flaunts its power and its advancing this nuclear option since it's almost playing into the hands of the U.S. who at least the globalists want to attack Iran, and they're getting this free fodder from Iran itself. For instance, this very week, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced that Iran had succeeded in enriching uranium on a small scale to the point of it being able to be used in nuclear reactors, which is a major step in their nuclear weapons phase.
And, of course, the thing is that Ahmadinejad has said that, certainly Israel should be wiped off the face of the map, that the Holocaust never happened, that Israel should be transported from Palestine to Europe. Why would he be making such stupid statements? Why is he doing everything to antagonize the United States? He can pretend to be negotiating. He's not. He's doing everything to actually engender, to encourage an attack on his country. So much of what's going on doesn't make sense if you look at it logically. But if you look at it from the point of view that there are people who want a third world war, it makes a lot of sense. Go ahead, Andrew, and our guest is Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Go ahead.
Thank you. As we were talking about, Iranian President Ahmadinejad has been forcefully advancing his opinions about and flaunting his position about keeping his nuclear arms research and advancing it further, which have produced in the U.S. a flurry of news stories advancing and advocating the use force and preemptive strikes against Iran. Jim Lobe reported a great deal about this. He says, in a veritable blitz of editorials and opinion pieces published Wednesday and Thursday, including the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, the National Review, all of these warn that Tehran had passed a significant benchmark once it declared with its quest for nuclear weapons, and that the administration must now plan in earnest to destroy Iran's known nuclear facilities, as well as possible military targets to prevent it from retaliating. And this is echoed throughout all kinds of newspapers, including the London Sunday Times, the Forward, which is the main weekly of the U.S. Jewish community, and the Washington Post, the New Yorker, CNN. Everyone is talking about these strikes against Iran and the coming effects about this.
And Chris, what we're really talking about is a preemptive strike. In other words, they don't have to attack us. We're going to attack them because we don't like what they're doing. But if we justify preemptive strikes, in other words, striking because, well, you feel that somebody may be an enemy, well, how then could we complain if Russia or China were to launch a preemptive strike on America? And if we launch a preemptive nuclear strike on Iran, and apparently that is very seriously being considered, then how could we justify or any complaint, or how could we register any complaint if there should be a preemptive nuclear strike on New York and Chicago and Miami and San Francisco and Los Angeles? I mean, after all, if we justify it or it's all right for us to do it, how could we complain if some other country were to do that to us? This is a terrible thing to anticipate or to actually advocate, isn't it, Andrew? A preemptive strike and even possibly a preemptive nuclear strike on a country that is of no danger to the United States?
It does. For a country that is no danger to the United States, it certainly does. Obviously, it's not necessarily wise, in my personal opinion, to wait until a country actually attacks us to retaliate. So there is a moral cause for doing a preemptive strike, but I believe that this is not the case, especially if you compare Iran with North Korea and China and Russia and multiple other nations which possess full power with nuclear arms, and compare and contrast that with what power Iran has, and it does not match the moral justification for a preemptive strike. As a side note, I would say that the only force that should be taken.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back with Andrew Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're talking about the preemptive strike that is being talked about, a preemptive strike on Iran, because, well, we don't like their policies. They may be trying to develop nuclear weapons. Maybe they are trying to develop nuclear weapons, but after all, China has nuclear weapons. They've threatened to attack us and nuke Los Angeles. North Korea has nuclear weapons. They've threatened to attack the United States. Iran has never threatened to attack the United States. Certainly, Iran is surrounded by nations that do have nuclear weapons, India, Pakistan, China, Russia. But we say, oh, well, thinking it's all right for them to have nuclear weapons, but we're going to attack you if you try to get, nuclear weapons. There's something wrong about everything, wouldn't you say?
I do. And I was about to explain that In my personal moral opinion, there is room for a preemptive strike, but only if there is real and definite, if there were, for instance, a leader of a country that voiced his intent and obvious intent. intent with the capability to follow through with that intent to attack the U.S. directly, then it would be permissible to use force, you know, taxpayer-supported force against that person to support our own national interest, but only to use that amount of force that would remove that threat, which most of the time would just involve a pinpointed strike to eliminate that leader. How does this contrast with what has happened in Iraq and Iran? Well, in Iraq, of course, we have gone in and completely occupied a territory which has no moral justification. We have not used the minimum amount of force. It's clear that there were multiple opportunities for the U.S. to eliminate the threat of Saddam Hussein, if he was truly a threat, which is in doubt as well. And the same issues here with Tehran, whether or not they are actually a imminent threat, and whether or not it should be a full scale strike or simply a surgical precision strike, so to speak, to eliminate the leaders, is where I believe the U.S. is crossing the line from being morally justified to being immorally antagonistic.
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about Iraq, certainly Saddam Hussein was a wicked and evil man, but we carry a book called See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent working in Iraq in 1995 up in Kurdistan. He said that he never met an Iraqi who didn't believe the United States government was keeping Saddam in power. He mentioned two times when the military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and each time we betrayed the military officers who were then arrested and tortured to death. Now, why, if he was such a wicked man, didn't we try to get rid of Saddam Hussein and let his own military overthrow him? Why were our leaders so intent upon a justification for invading Iraq? And that's really what it's all about. I think that the people in the Islamic world realize we had planned this attack long before. We had financed Saddam Hussein, the wicked Saddam Hussein, all during the 1980s, even after he had gassed the helpless people in Kurdistan, and whether it was 10,000 or 100,000 he killed, doesn't matter. Our government continued to back Saddam Hussein right up until, of course, he invaded Kuwait, and we actually encouraged him to invade Kuwait. And then when he did, of course, we retaliated. In fact, if you read the book by Bob Woodward, I think it's five presidents or six presidents, he tells how George Bush's, first George Bush's associates wanted to go to Saddam and tell him to get out of Kuwait. And George Bush says, you can't go over and talk to Saddam and tell him to get out of Kuwait. We have to have this war. Speaking of the first Gulf War, none of this really makes sense unless there's a timetable they're following. And that timetable, step by step, is leading us, I believe, into World War III. So you pick up the story there.
I absolutely agree. And it's difficult to tell exactly how many players are involved with fomenting these conflicts. It's clear that Saddam Hussein was supported by the CIA initially, put into power there, and that he was allowed to maintain that power through the CIA and our covert operations. And now we have the president of Iran adding fuel to the fire of this strike against its own country. What is it causing these leaders to take these steps and allow the U.S. to take its military actions against these countries? That's a big question.
Well, I think we're in a very, very difficult situation, ladies and gentlemen. And it seems that the people in the White House are intent upon going to war with Iran. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen. Andrew, pick up the story there, please.
All right. Well, I think one of the possible reasons why Iran is acting with such confidence here, saying that they will not back down even one iota that they are even investigating a new high-speed torpedo and a new missile, importantly both of which are made possible using Russian technology and Russian aid, is that I think that they have been given assurances, possibly by Russia and or China, that they will be fully supported in any of their endeavors. We know, for instance, that much of the nuclear technology that comes to Iran has been made possible with Russian and Chinese technology transfers and scientist transfers, who are helping them with this with this technology and this development that they are achieving. So I think that they feel like they are backed by these huge countries, and that these allies of theirs will not allow them to be attacked by the U.S. And I think that's misplaced. That in fact the Russian Chinese axis wants them to antagonize the U.S. so that the U.S. can play its role as the aggressor, thus fomenting hatred against the U.S. and further justifying a future world war where the other global powers attack the U.S. With nuclear weapons and that, of course, will take a great deal of hatred amongst the world to attack the U.S. and be justified by the people.
But, of course, if you look at it from a practical point of view, a lot of this doesn't make sense. If you look at it from a spiritual point of view, we are told, you know, that God brings judgments on nations that have turned against him. And is there anybody in the listening audience who doubts that America has turned against God? We've taken God and prayer out of our schools. We've taken the Ten Commandments down off the walls of our courthouses and out of our schoolhouses. You know, they want to take the Christ out of Christmas. Watch our televisions. You know, watch television. Understand everything is being done to undermine the very fabric of our society. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen as we begin to evaluate some of what's going on in the world today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andrew, would you like to get your website out, telephone number? How can people get in touch with you if they'd like to get the World Affairs Brief?
I think that the best method for getting the World Affairs Brief is for people to log on to our website, www.worldaffairsbrief.com, and they can peruse what we think are the most important articles out there today. We pull from sources all over the internet to give people what we think are the most important news topics from all over the internet, and they can also find links there to order the weekly email edition of the brief, which I highly recommend to keep up to date. And for those people who don't have access to the internet, they can order a free copy of the brief to be sent to them by mail by calling 1-877-518-5888. That's 877-518-5888.
All right, I can recommend the material in the World Affairs Brief. I always look forward to the weekly summation by Joel, and certainly on the internet, why you can pull it down every day of the week, including Sunday, and always fascinating up-to-date information you need to know to keep abreast of what's going on. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
All right. Well, just to kind of wrap up the story with Iran, we have seen, I think it was probably 6 or more months ago that we here at the World Affairs Brief were talking about the Bush administration's intent to attack Iran, and many people thought at that time that it was unthinkable that this would happen, and yet we are starting to see how this takes effect and comes about. People wonder, well, how is it that you Americans can have the support of your people to send an army over and started attacking a country. And we are seeing exactly how that comes about. And it comes about by stories in the media creeping in, and then we hear it over and over again talked about. And now I think we are coming to the point where everybody around us realizes that this is a very real, if not an assured theme, this attack on Iran. The question now is not if, but how.
And, of course, if we do attack Iran, I mean, what's it going to do to the price of oil? And what's it going to do then to the price of everything we buy in our stores? Certainly, if Iran were to cut off its oil and were to close the Straits of Hormuz, which it has the ability to do, and I think about a quarter of all the oil in the world goes through that area, why, you know, this is going to impact not only on our economy, but the economy of the rest of the world, and infuriate these people. And then, of course, if we were to attack them, should we be surprised if they would retaliate against us? And I really believe, from everything I've studied, that they probably have some nuclear weapons that they bought from other countries, probably the Soviets or the Chinese or the North Koreans, and they would be able to launch those or smuggle them into our countries. What would one nuclear bomb in New York do to the stability of our nation? And when you enter into a war, you never know how it's going to end. And there was never a good war, and there was never a bad peace. But our leaders are intent upon war. They were intent upon attacking Afghanistan, not to catch Osama bin Laden, because they didn't try. And we went, of course, into Iraq, because we had to fight terrorism, and we've got far more terrorism than we had before that we attacked Iraq. And have they really considered what's going to happen? And the possibility of retaliation on our own nation here? Because if the American people don't speak out against this, no one should complain at all if the unthinkable should happen. And our cities should come under attack right here in the United States. We have to speak out and demand that they do not go to war under any circumstances. And if President Bush insists on it, that he be impeached. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that you bring up some very important points, that Iran is not just another Iraq that we can calmly occupy, or at least fairly easily occupy. They have much larger coordination with their, and much more powerful weapons, as well as strategic locations and control of the supply of oil. So it will be very interesting to see how this goes into effect. Here at the World Affairs Brief, we are of the opinion that this attack will not include a full-scale invasion, but will rather take place in the form of just airstrikes against those areas that have been labeled as being part of the nuclear weapons research, as well as a few other strategic areas. Whether or not we will have to send in troops to a portion to secure the Strait of Hormuz or not is difficult. It's kind of up in the air about how Iran will take this, but I think that they will see that their major backers, Russia and China, will not support an all-out war against the U.S. And so I think that to a certain extent they will take the blows from the airstrikes to a certain extent, like I said, and just kind of swallow it with the added hatred that goes along with that. Whether or not, because we don't think that this is going to be the final spark that's going to trigger World War III yet. We think that that things still have to progress a little further before World War III will actually take place.
I hope and pray that you're right, Andrew. I hope and pray you're right.
Yeah. It's difficult to tell that it could go either way quite easily. Iran is not a simple thing to trifle with. And there's a lot of talk going back and forth about whether or not to use tactical nuclear weapons to be able to get down into the deep reinforced nuclear research is taking place. And if the U.S. does decide to use nuclear weapons in an attack rather than a defensive mode, then it'll completely change the landscape and positioning of all of the global superpowers with respect to the use of nuclear weapons, and it could very well provide the ultimate spark for World War III. Like I said, we don't think that they'll revert to that. In fact, instead, it's very likely that they will use some of our the last 500 remaining Minuteman missiles that we have, the ballistic missiles that we have, but they'll reconfigure them to put conventional armaments on them to be able to achieve precision missile strikes from a long distance without endangering U.S. personnel, which is of course a very hot topic among all of the people here. And we at the World Affairs Brief would be very sad to see more of our last nuclear defense missiles used in this capacity, and more that is being brought up as an option, as no expense is spared to be able to hide the dirty effects of going to war, including of course U.S. casualties. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, to say the least.
And of course, if we launch an airstrike on Iran, does anybody think that the Iranians will do everything they can to foment the war in Iraq? And of course, many of the Shia militias over there are actually sympathetic to Iran. Iran has been sending money into Iraq. And what they're going to see is ever more strikes on our own forces in Iraq, and we will never be able to get out of there. The tempo of violence will really increase, and Iran will then do everything they can to increase the civil war and the violence in Iraq to kill more Americans. So you can't simply do something and not recognize there are going to be reactions to it. To every force, there's an equal and opposite force, and I think when we, if we do attack Iran, and I hope and pray that you're wrong, but I fear that you're right, if we do attack Iran, I think there are going to be unanticipated consequences of a terrible and frightening nature.
It is, and it's absolutely mind-boggling the effect that attacking Iran would have. I mean, we're so vulnerable in Iraq. Their strategic position is so much stronger than what we've seen in Iraq. It could have serious and long-term consequences. I think, though, that it'll take a while for those consequences to play out, and it could very well be the final spark that ignites this tinderbox, this Pandora's box, really, that is Iran and the Middle East, and has historically always been the tinderbox that ignites world wars, if you examine history.
Okay, fine. I certainly agree with you, and I share your concern.
And let's kind of switch topics and talk about immigration, because it kind of goes along with what you were talking about, the danger from Iran, possibly smuggling terrorists, etc., past our borders and creating havoc right here at home. One of the possible effects of this Pandora's box that we're talking about is things occurring right here in our own backyard. I think that the Americans would be very surprised if the world was suddenly brought to our home front. It's pretty easy to go along with the bandwagon if it's clear across the world, but if immigration across our borders isn't tightened up, then we will have serious and significant homeland security problems here. To address this topic, it's clear that, in fact, the homeland security measures that have been enforced up until now have not been about closing down our borders and securing ourselves from foreign invaders of any kind, but has actually been to allow them to continue, to allow massive amounts of immigration to enter our country. And it's creating quite a bit of conflict here. In fact, a recent poll by Time magazine showed that a great deal of Americans favor building a security fence along not just the 700 miles that the recent bill that passed the Senate would initiate, but rather extend a border fence the entire 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border from sea to sea. And
they could really do that. They could build that fence, you know, in a couple of months if they hired a dozen contractors. What good would it do to build a 700-mile fence when you got a 2,000-mile border? It's all smoke and mirrors. It's rhetoric over reality. It's confusing the American people to think that you're doing something. But the United States Senate and most of the members of the House of Representatives really don't want to stop illegal immigration because they're globalists. They have a different worldview. They want to destroy our sovereignty and merges with Mexico. And when you understand that, everything makes sense. Otherwise, nothing makes sense.
That's right. I think that you're absolutely right on there. I think that allowing illegal immigration or fomenting and encouraging illegal immigration has three main purposes for the globalists. It encourages conflict, it dilutes liberty, and it dilutes those freedom-loving people that are here and loyal to the government, and it promotes the FTAA and the combining of and dissolving of our borders with between the U.S. and Mexico, which, of course, a great deal of people who are now here in our country and living south of the border would like to see happen. The recent push by the Republicans through Congress of the immigration bills, I think, are worth noting. The Republicans here have really caved in on the amnesty bill that President Bush has been pushing for so long. I think that we will eventually actually see this guest worker program that Bush has been promoting actually come to be put into effect.
And, of course, he keeps saying, this isn't amnesty. We're not giving them amnesty. We're just going to let them stay here and become citizens. You know, he can say these things, and so many of our good people nod and say, yes, that's right, because we support President Bush because he's such a fine, God-fearing man. But he has done everything he could to encourage illegal immigration. He has no intention of sending this back because he's already made an agreement with both the president or a premier of Canada and the president of Mexico to merge our countries into one nation. This was done a year or so ago, and it's reported by the Council on Foreign Relations, and we hope to be able to have that their publication to point out exactly what has been agreed upon. But they cannot tell the American people because this is an act of treason. I mean, George Bush swore to uphold our Constitution, and protect it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We will no longer have a Constitution once we lose our sovereignty, and that's exactly what the Bush administration is doing. They want to destroy our sovereignty. That's why they've encouraged illegal immigration, steadfastly refused to enforce the federal laws against the large corporations that are hiring the illegal aliens. And, of course, if they use their power of the law, there would be no jobs, and the people would all go home. But as long as they refuse to enforce the laws, which were enacted back in 1986 for just a time such as this, why, the illegal immigration invasion will continue, and that's exactly what the Bush administration wants. But they can't tell the American people the one reason we're over in Iraq, distract us from what's going on home. So our young men are fighting for freedom overseas, and we're being invaded here at home, and we're losing our freedom here at home.
That's right, that's right. Many people wonder, well, what's the proper way to allow immigration to take place, to allow those good people who want to be good citizens of the U.S. through. And I I think that there actually is an appropriate method to allow selective immigration to come in through private contracts with citizens who are here in the country who are willing to take full assumption of responsibility for the conduct of the immigrant workers that they bring in by sponsor.
And we had a good guest program, a guest worker program in the past, and it worked and worked well. But you see, they don't want a solution. The leaders of this country want a problem. Well, Andrew, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
All right. Let me bring just one item to light, then, in regard to this illegal immigration and deportation. It was reported recently that there were several thousand illegal Chinese immigrants who were deported back to China. Actually, it was 39,000. If we view this in contrast to what is happening with the over 12 million illegal Mexicans who we very rarely deport across, it puts kind of in perspective the dichotomy of what the Bush administration is trying to do. They are concentrating on these few thousand Chinese, deporting them back to China who does not give permission for people to leave the U.S. In fact, it's illegal for them to do so, and they face harsh consequences when they arrive back.
Like being sent to prison and tortured, and so we're going to send them back there. Yeah, but to give the people of China the feeling there's no escape. Yet we refuse to send the people back to Mexico, who can go back without fear of punishment. We actually capture people trying to escape from Cuba and send them back where they're imprisoned. Why would we support the communists and help those regimes and yet encourage illegal immigration from Mexico? There's something inconsistent, isn't there?
That's right. It's not about enforcing illegal immigration. It's about kowtowing to China. The few examples that we have of people being deported back to Mexico is just a free ride back, and they just turn around and go right back across the border. So there's a dichotomy here that is very evident, that if they really want to deport and stop illegal immigration, the current laws on the books have plenty of statutes to allow them to enforce immigration if they wanted to, but they don't. And in fact, we see them using it in multiple situations, such as when they entice them to come out in the streets in these big riots. And there is a good example of thousands of illegal immigrants that could be rounded up in one spot and deported or whatever. I think that it should be very clear to people that this is a important.
We're out of time. Hold that thought. Well, I guess it's been Andrew Skousen. Andrew, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us. Once again, your website.
Our website is www.worldaffairsbrief.com, or people can call toll free 877-518-5888.
One more time, the telephone number.
Sure, 1-877-518-5888.
God bless you, Andrew. We'll look forward to getting on real soon.
Thank you, my pleasure, Dr.
Great, time just went by so quickly. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Andrew Skousen. I hope you enjoyed our program with him. And certainly, we hope that many of you will think very seriously about what's going on. You really need to read my January and February letters. My January and February newsletters are available up on the internet at radioliberty.com. And you'll learn about the Hojatiya Society, an organization in Iran that really wants to precipitate worldwide chaos. And Mr. Ahmadinejad is part associated with that, Mr. Ahmadinejad being, of course, the president of Iran today. And he's playing right into the hands of our leaders who have a very, very similar goal. I believe that they also want to create world chaos. So you say, why would they do that? It is simply because they have a different goal. They want to bring about a world government. They are globalists, and war is a very efficient means of changing society, isn't it? If you've not yet actually heard my talk on Iraq, the untold story, and got the syllabus that goes with that, why, of course, this goes into the background of all of the wars of the last century, and they were all fought for exactly the same reason, to bring about a world government. But we can't tell the American people about that, and of course most people really don't understand the spiritual implications of this move to create a world government with a one world leader. If you read the occult as I do, the writings of Share International, Benjamin Krem, the writings of the Lucius Trust, they were quite open about it. These Luciferians want to bring about a world government. And so do the people in the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you go into the origin of the Council on Foreign Relations, you find it came out of a secret society that was created in 1891 by Cecil John Rhodes, who himself and all of his followers were deeply involved in the occult. Now, that's all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and we hope that many of you out there will certainly want to get a copy of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. I want to mention I am going to be speaking at the Conspiracy Conference on May 27th, May 28th, that's in Santa Clara, at the Hyatt Regency Hotel, the Hyatt Regency Hotel. If you'd like more information on the Conspiracy Conference, call 209-832-0999, that's 209-832-0999, or their website, www.conspiracycon.com, and our next guest for the next hour, Ted Gunderson, is going to be there, John DeCamp, a number of excellent speakers, and then, of course, we remember our telephone number if you'd like to get in touch with my ministry, or perhaps join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. You can certainly listen to our programs there 5 hours a day on the Internet. If you'd like to get a free copy of perhaps my February newsletter, which will give you tremendous insight into what's going on, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and then pray for America. Pray for a revival, because this country doesn't turn back to God. Do you think God is going to protect us in the terrible times that lie ahead? And then please pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it is going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Ted Gunderson, who was 27 years with the FBI. He actually retired in the late 1970s after being in charge of the Los Angeles office of the FBI. And he set up then a consulting firm where he would actually investigate crimes. And, of course, one of the most famous crimes he investigated was the story of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald. And Dr. McDonald was a Green Beret, captain of the Green Berets, who had come home one evening and found his pregnant wife slaughtered and his two children slaughtered, and he was charged with their murder. Now, I'm going to let Ted Gunderson tell you the story of, what he found. But I will tell you, there was recently an article in the New York Times, which, of course, I like to find out what the enemy is saying, but once in a while they put in something that's honest and true. They leave out the important things, but it mentioned that now the defense attorney for Dr. McDonald had actually had a witness, and this was the marshal, the U.S. marshal, who'd actually taken a woman to see the prosecutor who was prosecuting Dr. McDonald, and we're talking about in the late 1970s. Dr. McDonald's been in prison for 25 or more years. And this marshal had heard this woman tell the prosecutor, who sent Dr. McDonald to prison, that she was part of a group that had been there and carried out the slaughter, and she had watched this, and the prosecutor said to her, and the marshal heard this, and he's telling the story 25 years later, prosecutor said, if you say that on the stand, I'll prosecute you for murder. And so she changed her story. The prosecutor didn't want the truth. He was intent upon sending an innocent man to prison. So you pick up the story, Ted, because you know it far better than I do.
Well, I find, Dr. Stan, again, thank you very much for having me on your show. A little correction on you. He didn't come home from work. He was there that night, and they attacked him also. But he lived through the attack, and he was actually laying on the couch and asleep, and they came up to him, two white males, a black male, and a white female with the floppy hat, and the girl was yelling, acid is groovy, kill the pigs, kill the pigs. And he said, what are you doing here? And there was a fight ensued. There was a paring knife, there was an ice pick, and a 32-inch bed slat that were weapons. And he had taken his pajama tops top parts and wrapped them around his wrists and was fainting off the blows, and all of a sudden he felt a sharp pain to his right side, lost consciousness, and when he awoke, he was half in the living room and half in the hallway, and the house was totally silent. And so he went back to the back bedroom. His wife had, I think it was, 20-some stab wounds in her. There were 100 stab wounds in the three bodies, by the way, the 5.5 and a 2.5-year-old child. And he wrapped his pajama tops in over top of Colette, the wife, and then he called the paramedics, and then when they arrived, he had fainted, and he was laying across her, and they accused him, of course, of committing the crime, said he was faking Manson, because the Manson murders that occurred in August of the previous year. I'll hear the music, Dr. Stan.
Hang on, we'll be back in just a moment. This is an incredible, incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Ted Gunderson. So Ted, of course, was then, Dr. McDonald was convicted and sent to prison for three consecutive life sentences, then you were contacted. Why don't you tell the story from there?
Well, yeah, some of his members of his defense team came to me and said, the man's innocent. Will you investigate the case? Now, I was out of the Bureau. I'd been out of the Bureau since March, and this was in December of 1979. And so I went to Dr. McDonald, who was the terminal line on the prison outside of Los Angeles, and I told the doctor, I said, if you committed these crimes, I don't want any part of it, but if you are innocent, I'll work with you. And I was very apprehensive at first until I developed information about the girl in the floppy white hat. That was Alina Stokely. And when I went back there in January, I went to her brother Clarence's house with Prince Beasley, a retired police officer, and talked to Clarence and said, Clarence, we want to talk to your sister. And we finally prevailed. He didn't want to do it at first. And finally he said, go to a payphone. We'll call, have her call you. He left. We went to the payphone. She called, and she basically told me and Prince that she wasn't going to cooperate. And her husband got on the phone, Ernie Davis, and he told us so many words to just forget it. We're not going to work with you. We're not going to help you. And I told Aline at that time, I said, Aline, I'm going to solve this case, and I'm going to find out who was in the house that night. And I hope that you're the one that tells me about it, because if I get it from somebody else, you're in big trouble. And I think that preyed on her mind for the whole time up until I finally had an opportunity to interview her one-on-one in October of 1980. October 1980, because I was back there all the month of January 1980 in North Carolina. And these murders occurred February 17th, 1970 at Fort Bragg. And the reason for the cover-up is because Alina told me that her satanic cult group was involved in distributing drugs up and down the East Coast. And they went in on their own without the approval of the higher-ups in the drug operation. And the higher-ups realized that if there was an investigation of this cult who were distributing their drugs, that it could have repercussions and expose the whole operation, because not only was the Army and the CIA bringing the drugs in to Fort Bragg, they were bringing them in all over America to various bases. This is in January, in Time Magazine, January 1, 1973, by the way. And I went to the UCLA Library, and I said, you know, this is such a massive drug operation. And Lena said there were two generals. There were generals involved. No, she didn't say two. She said there were generals involved. There were two attorneys in Fayetteville were involved. Said that there were police officers involved. There were enlisted men involved. But I figured, you know, this has to be a big operation.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ted is basically saying that the reason, of course, that this had to be covered up, the murder, was because it involved a satanic cult that had gone in and killed, sacrificed, of course, the pregnant wife of Dr. McDonald, killed his children. But they were simply drug distributors for a government CIA drug smuggling operation that was during this time, during the Vietnam War, was smuggling drugs back into this country in the abdominal cavities of the casualties of the men who died in Vietnam. And this went to the highest levels of our government, and they were afraid that if the investigation went into who really killed the McDonald family, his wife and his children, that it would begin to expose this operation at the highest level of our government. So anyway, you got this story then from the woman who was there, and you actually have a videotape confession, signed confession, don't you?
Well, I have I was with her on three different sessions, 10 days each, a total of about 30 days. And we went into a lot of detail, and my first report was 1,100 pages, by the way, which included signed statements from her. And she gave me all the details about the murder, but would not talk about satanic cults. And it was, but actually she did say that it was her initiation into the cult that particular night. And, but she would not give any details about cult activity or the ceremony.
And she was afraid they would kill her
She told me they'd kill her if she told that.
And they killed her anyway, didn't they?
They killed her anyway. She died in January 1983. Now, the autopsy shows that she died of slight pneumonia of each lung and cirrhosis of the liver. And, but she was dead on the couch. Nude from the waist down, and the kitchen faucet was running. Water is one of the satanic signs, by the way. They always leave a sign behind when they murder somebody. The average investigator has no idea what it means, or what have you. But thanks to Mr. Ken Lanning of the FBI. And but anyway, her 6-month-old boy was on the alive on the floor on the rug, and he did survive. But I'm sure, you know, the first son of the family, of the cult family, is usually sacrificed. So I'm sure that little boy's probably been sacrificed. There's between 50 and 60,000 human sacrifices a year in the United States alone, and these cults are also active across around the world, primarily in the in Europe. Very active in England also, in France and Germany and so forth. It's a big operation. It's a huge operation. And in the United States alone, we have about, I estimated, about 4 million of them.
Would you like to tell our listeners about the book written by Maury Torrey called The Ultimate Evil, that goes into the background of the Son of Sam killings and the Manson killings?
Yes, well, that ties into satanic cults, the OTO, Oro Templo Orientis, the Process Church. Maury Torrey did a fabulous job in that book. He said he spent like 7 or 8 years writing it, and it described in detail about the operation. The fellow named Charles Manson II. This was after the Manson murders. Later identified him as Bill Mentzer, and he was involved in the murder of Roy Radin, the Hollywood producer from Long Island, New Yorker, came to Los Angeles, to Hollywood, because there was a contract dispute. And Mentzer, a fellow named Lowe, and a fellow named LaMotta, and a woman named Lonnie Jacobs, Roy Radin had a dinner engagement with Lonnie, and Mentzer and Lowe drove him, and they took him out about 65 miles north of Los Angeles and took him off into the side road and blew him away. They put a candle in his, after they shot him, they put a candle in his, in between his teeth, and not a candle, but a stick of dynamite, and of course there wasn't much left of him. But in that book, it's kind of interesting.
They talk about the book, The Ultimate Evil, by Maury Torrey, which I recommend to our listeners. I wish I could get it, but it's out of print. And after you understand it, it points out the Son of Sam killers. He was simply a member of a cult, and they refused, people back east refused to investigate the cult. There were some people who wanted to, some of the law enforcement did, but there were powerful people who blocked the investigation, and it ties into the Manson killings as well. You know, Charles Manson was affiliated with the Process Church, or at least a branch of the Process Church, to the Final Judgment, and this is just one of many satanic cults in our country. Would that be a fair statement,
Ted? That's absolutely true. The Roy Radin murder was a satanic murder. It was a hit. Mentzer is a killer. Bill Mentzer is a killer for the satanic cult. He's a professional killer. He's an ex-Marine, by the way. And it was kind of interesting. There's this little side story to this. Maury Torrey and I went out to the site where they found Roy Radin's body, and he'd been tipped off that there was a Bible underneath a tree there. There wasn't a Bible. There was a clue under the tree. We found the Bible turned to I think it's Psalms 22, verse 13, where drink of the blood, eat of the lamb. And these people are very they're very arrogant, very very clever. They always leave signs behind when they murder somebody. But anyway, that's kind of an overview. Maury Torrey's book is a fabulous book. I did a lot of work for him on the West Coast at the time that he was writing it. And this ties into, you know, a number of other cases that I've been involved in. The McMartin case in Manhattan Beach, California. The children said, it's also satanic, by the way. I can't say it was satanic, but from what the children said, it was obviously satanic. But the children said that this is a preschool, and these were 2-, 3-, 4-year-old kids that were taken to the school, dropped off in the morning. Their parents would pick them up late in the afternoon or in the evening. And it came out in the early 1980s that one of the little boys went home. He had blood in his diaper, and the mother looked further into the situation, found out that the kids started talking, and they said that there were tunnels under the school. They were taken through these tunnels up into the triplex next door and put in automobiles and prostituted, 2-, 3-, 4-year-old kids prostituted. And this, the kids said that there were ceremonies, there were humans, men and women, and black robes with no clothes on underneath, with candles, hooded, had hoods on, and they were chanting, and it was obviously a satanic ceremony. They said that they were murdering little babies, brown babies, probably Mexican children, on an altar and so on and so forth. But this is very, you know, like tonight is a full moon here. And there's going to be a number of ceremonies. There's, like I said, 50, 60,000 human sacrifices a year here in the United States. And there's 8 basic holidays when they sacrifice somebody. By the way, I also have 2 ceremonies on video that one of my informants has given to me. And I have a tape about satanic cults that's available on my website, tedgunderson.com.
No, I think it's so fascinating and really frightening as you begin to look into this. There really are satanic cults in this country. We carry a book by a man who was associated with what is called Diary of a Devil Hunter by Gregory Reed. And he was part of these satanic cults. Then, of course, he spent his life since coming out of it trying to expose what's going on. And the FBI and Washington representative goes all over the country trying to tell local police forces there are no satanic cults. There are just a few crazies out there, but there's no organized satanic movement. And yet, as you study this, you find out it goes into the upper echelons of our government. And you certainly have worked with Senator John DeCamp, haven't you? He was a state senator in one of the Midwestern states. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about that pedophile ring that goes right into Washington, D.C.?
Yes. By all means, but before I talk about John, let me finish a little story about the McMartin preschool case. The authorities went out there in 1987 and said the kids said that these tunnels, they looked for the tunnels, couldn't find them. I had an opportunity to take control of the property in 1991, hired an archaeologist from UCLA, Dr. Gary Stickle, and within 34 days, Dr. Stickle said, yes, there had been tunnels here, and they were filled in. So the kids were telling the truth. There was a trial, an extensive trial, a 2-year trial. Ray Buckey, who was the son of the owner, and the grandmother were involved in the trial. The grandmother was acquitted. Ray Buckey had a hung jury the first time. We found the tunnels in the middle of the second trial, called the district attorney, and said, hey, we found tunnels here, and they sent a fellow named Perez, an investigator, out, and he wanted to argue with Dr. Stickle, and said, there's no tunnels there. Here you have an investigator who's not an expert in that field arguing with an archaeologist. And anyway, they didn't use this evidence. And the reason, I think, is because the children had identified some of the high-level politicians in Los Angeles and movie actors and a number of very prominent people, so another cover-up.
What's really interesting, if you read the Wall Street Journal regularly, they're always saying this was a miscarriage of justice, there were no tunnels, there was nothing there, no satanic things. I wonder why the Wall Street Journal is covering up for these satanic crimes.
Well, Dr. Stan, the cults have infiltrated virtually every level of society, and it goes right up to the White House, to be frank with you. And John DeCamp was involved in what we call the Franklin cover-up. The Franklin Savings and Loan was raided by the IRS and the FBI back in the early 1980s. And there was publicity, there were pictures in the paper, and 80 children came forward and told their parents that one picture of that one individual, who was the president of the Franklin Savings and Loan, Larry King, not Larry King Live, but a black man in the Republican Party, 80 children came forward and said, that man molested me, mommy and daddy. And of the 80, there were 4 who gave signed statements and admitted that, and came forward and were willing to testify. The others refused. The parents wouldn't let them. And of those 4, one has disappeared. The other one died in a hospital. Both of the other 2, Paul Benassi and Alicia Owens, both went to jail. They had to discredit them, of course. But anyway, in this particular case, I hear music, so we'll come back to it, I guess.
No, you got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, in this particular case, Paul Benassi, when he was 10, 11, 12 years old, he was used as a decoy in parks and shopping malls to bring kids his age over, and the adults would grab and put him in a car and flee it, take off with them. This was an international child kidnapping ring known as the Finders, and I have this very well documented, and the Finders is a CIA child kidnapping operation.
CIA, in other words, it gets right into at least the dark side of our intelligence agencies. All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Ted Gunderson. Amazing stories, could they be true? I believe they are. Well, Ted, pick up the story from there.
Well, Paul Benassi, I interviewed him I have a 5-hour interview with him, by the way, on the video. and he's a mind control victim, and Paul told me that he's attended six auctions where they had children up on the stage, anywhere from 2 to 20, 21 years old. The kids are all put up on the stage in their underwear. They put a tag around their neck with a number on it, and the people in the audience bid on the number. These various locations, one was in Toronto, Canada. One is outside Las Vegas, Nevada, in an airfield about 50 miles away, and I think I've spotted that one. Another one was a barn in Lincoln, Nebraska, Houston, Texas, and also in Michigan. And these kids sell for up to $50,000. And according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is an adjunct to the U.S. Department of Justice, by the way, they've been in existence for some 25 years. Last year, they had access to $49 million. And as of last year, they had located 137 children in 25 years with access to $49 million. Give me $1 million, and I'll double that in 6 months, or in probably 2 months, or maybe a month even.
But how many children disappear and are never found again?
Well, according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, there are 91 people disappear in this country every hour, and it is estimated between 85 and 90% of them are children. So it's a big operation. And the Finders, and by the way, this is one of my reports, the Finders, and it's available also on my website, tedgunderson.com. But I worked with John DeCamp on this case, and they were taking children out of Boys Town, orphanages, and foster homes, and in Omaha, Nebraska, driving them to Sioux City, Iowa, 184 miles away, placing them in private jets, flying them to Washington, D.C. for sex orgies with congressmen, senators, ambassadors, and so forth. And, of course, you know what happens there. Then that's called blackmail or extortion, whatever you want to call it. But as a result, of course, these congressmen, senators are told how to vote, or if you don't vote, we're going to expose you. You have that little boy. They call them toys. Boys are called toys. Last Friday night, and this is Monday, you better vote on this bill for us, or you will regret it later on. So they have a lot of blackmail material. This is a typical CIA blackmail operation. And anyway, this case, this Franklin cover-up case, goes on and on. Larry King was finally prosecuted, not prosecuted, but he was prosecuted for the missing money at the Franklin Savings and Loan. There was like $2 million missing. And John DeCamp filed a civil suit against him and had a $1 million judgment. And John was standing on a street corner sometime after that in Lincoln, Nebraska. A stranger walked up to him and said, "If you ever collect the money, you won't live to spend it." So I told John I'm pretty sure it's in the Caribbean. The money's in the Caribbean. Larry King, in the meantime, is out. He went to prison for a short period of time, went to a country club operation up in Minnesota. And I think they say he's in Washington, D.C., but I've had some of my spotters spot him in New York City, so he might be moving between the two. He's very, very high in the Republican Party. And these boys were being furnished taken right into the White House. And Paul Benassi has drawn the inside living quarters of the White House. Now, you don't just get in there when you go in to visit the White House. You have to have inside contacts to get into the living quarters. But those are just a few of the cases I've worked. I guess I could go on.
Well, of course, I think it's so vitally important that our listeners understand there really is a satanic movement. There really are secret satanic sacrifices in America. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ted has worked John DeCamp, Senator John DeCamp. Of course, they got him out of office. They couldn't have anybody who was a responsible legislator exposing the pedophile rings that tied right into Washington, D.C., tied right into the White House. These things are so difficult for Americans to believe, that there could be this ultimate evil. But, of course, let me tell you, you really need to get Maury Torrey's book, The Ultimate Evil. I wish we could carry it. We do carry the book, The Diary of a Devil Hunter by Gregory Reed, however, which at least covers his personal experiences and trying to expose the satanic crimes in America. He spends a lot of time actually lecturing to police forces across America, trying to undo the harm that the FBI representative does, saying, "There's no such thing as satanic crime. It's all imaginary." Have you ever run into Gregory Reed?
No, I haven't, Dr. Stan. I've heard of him, though.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, then, of course, you have another amazing story. And this, is, of course, is a very, very similar story. It really shows that we hear all this talk about a war on terrorism. And maybe as a preface to what you're going to hear from Ted, let me tell you a story that's told to me by Paul Williams, who is the author of the book Osama's Revenge and the Al-Qaeda Connection. And Paul told me that he was contacted fairly recently by somebody living in Bakersfield who'd seen an internationally wanted Al-Qaeda terrorist, one of the men who's got his picture on a poster. He's wanted throughout the world as an Al-Qaeda terrorist. He goes to the local police in Bakersfield and they're not interested. He goes to the FBI and they're not interested. So he contacts Paul Williams, who actually follows up on the story, and I believe Paul actually went there and made sure it was accurate and reported it to both the police and the FBI, and nobody would investigate to find out if this was really this international Al-Qaeda terrorist, one of the people who is supposedly here in this country to blow up our cities and create all sorts of problems. Now, then, Ted's story is going to be very similar. You pick up the story, what happened to you, and about this woman.
Well, because of the work that I do, Dr. Stan, I'm contacted on a regular basis from various individuals around the country, and in July I had a phone call from a preacher. And he said that there was a girl in a religious group who was being protected in San Diego, California, and that she had been the ex-girlfriend of the leader of an Al-Qaeda sleeper terror cell in Los Angeles. And so he says, what am I going to do with her? I said, well, let me talk to her. So I live in Las Vegas, but I drove to Orange County, and I've interviewed her for 1 hour, for 4 hours, excuse me. On it, and I've got it on DVD, and it's available to you folks for $25, by the way. And so we took this DVD and wrote a memo. I interviewed her on July 17th. I wrote my memo on July the 20th, and I gave it to about 15 congressmen, senators. I gave it to every law enforcement, federal law enforcement agency, at the DEA, the INS, the FBI, and so forth, and then I told them, I said, this lady is available to be interviewed. Here's my 4-hour tape or 4-hour DVD, but I think you might want to talk to her yourself to confirm what she's telling me. And the agent I was dealing with, actually, I never did meet him in person. I talked to him on the phone, and I made sure he was given a copy of my interview. Was an agent named Bob Shirley out of Long Beach, California. And I said to her, I said, well, what am I going to do with you? And because she'd had death threats.
And, of course, first of all, none of the FBI people would really do anything about her. I mean, they wouldn't even bother to investigate this story that she was tied into and had been associated with this Al-Qaeda's terrorist ring, that they had a plan to well, I'll let you tell more about what their plan is and how they're going to work. But she knew where their safe houses was. She knew all about this Al-Qaeda terrorist cell. And the FBI, those people who were there supposedly to guard us and protect us from Al-Qaeda, they wouldn't even talk to her. So pick the story.
Well, what happened actually happened was that she had been the girlfriend of this leader. She's English, by the way, and these are Filipinos, for some 3.5 years, and she started asking too many questions. And they put her in a garage and kept her there for 3 weeks. She was held captive. She knew that they were poisoning her. And then last May, she overheard 5 of them in the next room say, we have the green light, let's go. And they did high fives, all of them, all 5 of them did. And that's when she really became suspicious, and that's when they put her in a garage. And so when she escaped, she walked the streets of Los Angeles for 2 days and 2 nights. She went to the Los Angeles police, and they laughed at her. They said, Al-Qaeda sleeper cell, what would they want with you, you know? She called the FBI on her cellular phone, and they said they'd call her back. They never called back. So that's how she came and became involved with this religious group in San Diego, and that's how I got to her.
All right, fine. Will you hang on there? We'll be back in just a moment with Ted Gunderson, 27 years with the FBI. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Ted Gunderson. Ted, you pick up the story there.
Well, so then we have a problem. I say, well, what am I going to do with you? And so she said, well, she had a friend in Connecticut, and maybe he can help me. So I had a speech in Huntington, Long Island, New York, and rather than fly back, we drove back. She and I drove, took turns driving, 2.5 days, 3,000 miles roughly, and went up and saw her. Her friend in Connecticut, he couldn't help her. And then I came down. The car was parked at the Hilton Hotel in Huntington for some 3 days during this conference and when I gave my speech. And then when we when it was over and we left, I noticed that the car had a funny sweet smell to it. And we became sick, became ill, and I examined the car, and there were two needle marks between the door and the door jamb on the passenger side. And I looked up at the headliner, and it looked like a half moon of liquid that had dried. And I realized then, and I realized since then, that we've been poisoned. Both of us have been poisoned. But anyway, we left Long Island, New York, and drove to Oregon, where I have a friend. And my friend there couldn't help me. So I brought her back down here to Las Vegas. And meantime, she met a nice man, a real nice young man. And they were married, and they're both living here with me, and I'm supporting them. But they can't go out; they can't go anyplace. They're being held captive here. Now I in the meantime write to Bob Shirley a letter, and I say this woman needs to be in the witness protection program. That's what it's for—to protect federal witnesses. She is a potential federal witness, and I haven't heard back from him. Excuse me. I went to the L.A. Times. And I gave them this information. Nothing happened there. I've been to the local paper here in Las Vegas, and I talked to the city editor, and he said, well, I'll talk to one of our reporters. I told him the story, and I said, I'll talk to one of our reporters and see if he has time to talk to you. And so everybody's just ignoring this girl. She has this information. Now, one good thing did come out of it. She said that she was sure that there was something was going to happen on August the 28th. And hang on just a minute. And INS did pick up two of the leaders of the cell on August the 26th. So I think that she prevented a terrorist attack from occurring in the Los Angeles area. Now, I asked her, I said, now what were they doing? Well, she knew of seven older cars, 1980 cars, that they had wired. And these cars were wired in such a manner that a bomb could be set off by a cellular phone.
In other words, there were explosives in the cars, but, of course, they haven't been detonated. I assume that they're waiting until the word is given for them to go ahead and set them up. Hang on there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ted was saying that this woman, that story was that group of terrorists, Al-Qaeda terrorists, were wiring cars with explosives, but of course the explosives were there, and they would be set off by cellular phones, but they have not been detonated yet. What do you think? They're sitting in junkyards, or they're sitting places where impounded cars are taken?
Yeah, what they were doing, they were deliberately leaving the cars on the street so they'd be impounded. And also, they wouldn't have proper papers, and then when the police would stop them, the police would confiscate the car, and then they'd be in police storage places or impounded areas and so forth. So there you have. I mean, if you had this happened in 10 different cities that have been targeted, by the way, and this according to Dr. John Hagee, pastor of the Cornerstone Church in Houston, Texas. He has a confidential source high in the international intelligence community. And in his book, Jerusalem Countdown, he states that the Al-Qaeda sleeper cells are established and ready to activate nuclear attacks in seven U.S. cities. And these cities are Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Houston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Miami, and New York City. And then your friend, Dr. Paul Williams, professor at Scranton University, has confirmed this and says there's actually 10 cities. And this would be Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Houston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Miami, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Valdez, Alaska. Now, I think it's Paul Williams says, Hagee, I'm not sure which, that the cities where they have not established a foothold, the terrorists, are Philadelphia, Boston, and Valdez, Alaska. Now, if you will notice, if you look at the map of the United States, how those cities are strategically located so that the prevailing winds would prevent a fallout across the country. Valdez, Alaska is particularly of interest to us.
Because Valdez, Alaska, the reason it would hit that is because that's where the oil pipeline from the North Slope, from Prudhoe Bay, comes out. That's where the tankers come in to pick up the oil from the North Slope of Alaska. So if they should hit that with a nuclear blast of some sort, it would have a profound impact on the oil supplies.
And U.S. Congressman Kurt Weldon, Republican of Pennsylvania, who's vice chairman of the Armed Services Committee, in his book, Countdown to Terror, has developed intelligence information concerning imminent terrorist attacks by al-Qaeda terrorists. He's furnished this to the CIA, and he's being ignored. And I would have to guess that maybe Congressman Weldon is a friend of Dr. Paul Williams, and that's how Dr. Williams obtained his intelligence information.
Well, we actually have talked to other people tied into intelligence that have told me that there are Iranian terror cells here. Now, these there may be al-Qaeda terror cells as well, but there are Iranian terror cells, and they've been here for many years. In fact, you go back, we have a book written in 1993 by Yosef Badansky, who was a senior advisor to the Republicans in the House of Representatives. He's a researcher, and in his book, Target America, in 1993, he talked about the Iranian terror cells that were already here. But they're not going to do anything until the orders come. And this is the thing. There are all sorts of terror cells here. They are not doing anything. They will not do anything until the orders are given. My fear is that if we attack Iran, the orders may be given. So anyway, Cynthia, the woman has told you all sorts of things. Didn't she tell you about the safe houses that they had?
Yes, we got up at 3:30 one morning and went around all the safe houses. Figured we better not do that during the day because at that time they were looking for her. She has a death threat on her. And we...
How do you mean she has a death threat on her? Have they told her they'll kill her if they find her or what?
Well, when she was being held captive, they threw a brick in her garage with three holes in it. And she said that's a Filipino sign of a death threat with the three holes. And so that was when she tried to escape. She realized what was going on. She said we went around 3:30 one morning to I think it was eight different locations where these safe houses are, and we pulled out the addresses and we furnished that to law enforcement also, by the way. And nobody seems to want. Nobody seems to care.
Ted, do you ever have a feeling that maybe they already know that they're really watching the Islamic terrorists and all of these cells very, very carefully, but they can't tell the American people that they've been tracking this thing going back to the late 1980s? I know we've have this video made by Stephen Emerson that has film footage shot in 1988. Where Abdullah Azzam, who was the founder of al-Qaeda, is talking 1988, and there he is talking in Oklahoma City, in Oklahoma, about the coming jihad and blood running in the streets. These films, I believe, were shot by the FBI. The FBI knew all about al-Qaeda. They had all of their movements infiltrated before 9-1, but they can't tell the American people that any more than they can tell them that they were following Zacharias Moussaoui. If you read what he said early on, he said, I was tracked from the moment I came into America.
Well,
and he was. I mean, there's no question in my mind that he was in touch with Nicholas Berg, the poor fellow who got beheaded over there in Iraq. And you can go check all of this out on Google. Just type in Nicholas Berg and Zacharias Moussaoui, and you'll find they were together in Norman, Oklahoma. Certainly the FBI was checking on Moussaoui 11 days before the 9-1-1 attack. I talked to the woman who runs the Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma, 11 days before 9-1-1. The FBI, which has just had no idea what was going on, had no idea anything about Moussaoui other than what they were hearing from Minneapolis, they were in Norman, Oklahoma, checking on his experiences there at the flight school. They knew everything about him. They just can't let the American people know that they knew everything about him and all of the other hijackers as well.
Well, they may have known about him, but they did nothing to stop them.
Well, see, that's the thing. As you're trying to get to them with information from this woman that you've been befriending, and they don't want to hear the information because they have no intention of trying to stop the coming terrorist attacks.
Dr. Stan, I've used my retirement check to handle my own personal investigation in addition to cases like the McDonald case, the McMartin case, the Franklin cover-up. And I can tell you right here now, I have had all kinds of anti-terrorism training. I'm considered an anti-terrorist expert. And there's no way, there's absolutely no way that those four airplanes could have been skyjacked on September the 11th without us knowing about it in advance. Absolutely no way that that could have happened. Because when you have all the illegal telephone taps the NSA has, you just got to tell me, and you can document it, I know, and we can all document the fact that the FBI was watching the Al-Qaeda terrorists. I personally investigated Oklahoma City. I have a 222-page report on Oklahoma City. And I can tell you that there were four conventional bombs that were taken out of that building that did not explode. That was on the TV, and one of the commentators on TV that afternoon made the statement, oh, they're taking an unexploded bomb out. We're going to find out who's behind this now because it has U.S. Army stenciled on the side. And I personally investigated Oklahoma City, and I can tell you that I talked to one of the defense investigators. They talked to me for 4.5 hours, by the way, because of my report, and I had a considerable amount of details in there that was of extreme interest to the government. And I was told by a defense investigator that there were at least 11 other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, and that there were Middle Easterners involved in it. And then the car bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the New York Times made a mistake, as you said earlier in this show, and on October 28, 1993, they printed an article about how the FBI informant in among the terrorists, Joseph was the leader, he was, by the way, trained by the CIA, and the FBI informant was commissioned by the terrorists to put the car bomb together. He went to his FBI handler, we're going to use a dummy bomb, and his FBI handler said, no, we're going to use a real bomb. Now, the FBI not only knew in advance about the car bombing in February 26th, I think it was, 1993, they furnished the ingredients for the bomb.
Well, if any of our listeners would like to check that story, we actually have that clipping from the New York Times. And, of course, one of my friends called the author some years later and asked him about it. He said, I'm not allowed to talk about that. We have the article, though. Anybody would like to know that the FBI, you know, was contacted ahead of time about the plan, they refused, of course, to try to stop it. And if you'd like to get that article, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And after you've read the article, you'll understand why the reporter has been ordered not to discuss the article he wrote back in 1993. But we have the article. In fact, we actually got the article, and I think that we provided it to General Ben Parton, and he sent it out across the country. But you need to read these things, and you need to understand the government knew all about the bombing and in 1993 and refused to try to stop it. That is an incredible story. If you'd like the clipping, call us at 1-800-544-8927. Go ahead, Ted.
Well, you know, here's something else, Dr. Stan. I do not understand. If I was a congressman and a senator, they have to know about that clipping. Everybody else that's involved in this field, like you and I, commentators, radio talk show hosts, people involved in the movement, the activist movement, to try to expose corruption in our government, we are all aware of that. Why hadn't congressmen and the Senate done something about this?
I think that most of them are so busy, they really have... that don't have time to do the research. They depend upon the people who are the aides and assistants, and maybe they don't understand it either. But, you know, there's no question in my mind that some of the congressmen know exactly what this is about, and they're afraid to speak out. They might very well end up like Congressman George Hansen, sent to jail and harassed for 10 years when he was perfectly innocent. And after 10 years, after they destroyed his health and actually tortured him, and
in
he
prison.
Has the scars to
he's
prove
a U.S.
it.
Congressman tortured in prison.
Right. Do you know George Hansen?
I know him very well.
Is he still alive?
I hope so. A wonderful man.
He really was. Very, very courageous patriot. But, of course, he crossed the wrong people, and they trumped up charges, and they sent him to prison. After 10 years, they said, oh, shucks, George, we're sorry. You know, the crime that you were accused of, you never should have been sent to jail. The federal government had no authority to do that. Too bad, George. Well, we're going to give you a pardon. Your health is ruined. Your career is ruined. You've been bankrupted. And that's a good lesson to the rest of the congressmen, isn't it?
Well, yes, I'm sure that might have something to do with it, but we still need to stand up. I mean, look what's happened to you and to me and to the rest of us. And by the way, I've been on 3-year show. This is the fourth show I've been on this week, and it's kind of interesting because last night somebody just saturated my car with a white powder substance, and it's the same white powder smell that I've had in the past since July, when since I became involved with this young lady. And by the way, I have three times the amount of arsenic in me for optimum health, and I have a laboratory report that proves that, and I think it's from this white substance. My car last night was saturated with this.
Well, at least they're listening to our programs. Anyway.
Well, yeah, thanks a lot, Dr. Stan. You're really doing me a favor.
Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Jim.
I'm sorry to hear the news about the situation with the poisoning. So I just wanted to say that right off the bat before I go into my question.
Go ahead.
So, I wondered if, Ted, if you had done any research into this thing with George Bush, where he says that he saw the first plane hit the World Trade Center while he was sitting outside of the classroom in the school in Florida.
Well,
are you aware of that speech?
I've heard that. Everybody claimed what that was. It was a rehearsal for 9-1-1. Actually, when one of the planes hit, he was in there talking about goats with those kids in Florida.
And of course, the picture of the first plane hitting the tower wasn't available at that time. It wasn't available to the following day, so he couldn't possibly have seen that. He saw the picture of the second plane hitting the South Tower, if he saw anything at all.
Well, I heard the story, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that they had a rehearsal on this, and he was aware of the rehearsal, dress rehearsal. But I don't know if there's anything to that or not.
Well, we do know one thing, Jim, and that is that on that day, there were four military exercises and at least one of them involved a plane being hijacked and flown and crashed into the, either, I think it was into the Pentagon or into the CIA headquarters, so that actually this was designed to confuse the air traffic controllers. Now, either those were the smartest terrorists in the whole world, they just happened to pick the day, to attack the World Trade Center when they were going to have those military exercises, and this whole thing was contrived. I would rather think the latter. Certainly, the story, if anybody wants to check me out, is covered in a book called Pretext for War by James Bovard. That's Pretext for War by James Bovard. Or Crossing the Rubicon by Mark Rupert. Both of those tell about the military exercises. There's no question they were that day. And they were simulating a hijacked plane crashing into a government building. So why would Condoleezza Rice say, why, who would ever have thought that? And why would Dick Cheney have said, who would ever have thought something like that would happen? Didn't they know about the military exercises, or were they trying to deceive the American people? Do you have another question, Jim?
Well, yeah, about Dick Cheney in relation to this. You know, there's the, on the 9/11 Commission website, they have the testimony posted from Norman Mineta, where he was with Dick Cheney in the bunker under the White House. Have you seen that, Dr. Stan?
Actually, we covered that in my newsletters, yes. And he, of course, says that the man kept coming in. The plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 20 miles out. The plane is 10 miles out. Did the order still stand? And the vice president jerked his neck around and said, of course the order still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And somebody said that Norman Mineta, who's just made this testimony before the 9/11 Commission, well, what were the orders? And Mineta said, I don't know what the orders were. But they were tracking the plane that was coming into Washington, D.C., and specifically not doing anything about it.
Couldn't Dick Cheney at least have warned, send out a warning to Washington, or at least turned on the civil defense siren or something? I mean, he didn't even do anything. The plane just flew right in. He didn't do anything. There was no standard operating procedures followed to stop the plane from flying into Washington airspace.
Well, why don't we get Ted's comment on that? Ted?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about Cheney, exactly what he was doing that day. But I do know that as far as the Pentagon is concerned, that the opening was 16 feet across, and that the airplane has a wingspan of 120-some feet, I believe. So I don't think that there was an airplane that went into the Pentagon.
Well, we may never know, Jim. Anyway, there are lots of unanswered questions.
Yep. Well, it's on public record. I mean, it's at the 9/11 Commission website. It's right there. It's, you're not making it up. I'm not making it up. I just hope there's an investigation of that.
Well, anybody who would like to, of course, we have a little three-pamphlet set called $4 911. We give you the exact quotation of what was said and where anybody can check that out. But, this is really the best documentation I know of what happened that day. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Jim.
Yes.
And we've got, is this Margie who's calling?
Maggie, yes.
Maggie, okay, go ahead, Maggie. Would you just hang on there for just a minute?
Yes, thank you.
Ted, would you mind getting your website out and your address so people...
Yeah, my website is tedgunderson.com, tedgunderson.com. And I've got all kinds of interviews that I've conducted with various individuals.
Okay, let's get your address out because we're just about out of time.
1155 East Twain, TWAIN Avenue, number 108-259, Las Vegas, Nevada, 89109. That's Ted Gunderson, 1155 East Twain Avenue, 108-259, Las Vegas, 89109.
God bless him. Just hang on, Ted. We've got just a couple of minutes more. Well, we've got Maggie calling from Texas. Maggie, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, please. Mr. Gunderson, you earlier briefly alluded to the Process Church cult. Now, I have heard that that cult has sort of morphed into Best Friends, a big pet rescue-type operation that operates out of Utah, I believe. And I heard a fascinating interview with a researcher about... two or three years ago that was on the radio. Do you know anything about that, or is that being investigated at all?
About the Process Church being in Utah?
The leaders of that apparently resurfaced as pet lovers, and they started an operation called the Best Friends.
I don't know anything about
that. I don't know anything at all about that either.
Okay.
The Process Church was a very, very violent, at least the branch that were, David Horowitz and Charlie Manson were associated with, was very, very violent. And, of course, they were the Process Church to the final judgment. They were waiting for the time when they had this world government. The final judgment was coming. And they were basically Satanists. Anything else, Maggie?
Yes, I could email Mr. Gunderson some information about that if he
wants. Why don't you go ahead and do that, would you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks so very much.
Okay.
What did she want?
Oh, she's just going to email you some information.
Oh. Well, it's Ted Gunderson at Cox.net.
At Cox?
Yeah, TedGunderson@Cox.net. But my emails are being intercepted, so.
Yes, sir. Okay, I'll do
that. My websites are being crashed.
Yes, I was looking at your website a minute ago. It's a very good one.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Maggie. Bye-bye.
And something else that's happened to me, Dr. Stan, is I just found out that my fuses, my condominium here, have been played with, and they've been shorting out, and I took my look at them. They're defective, and I think they're trying to start a fire in my condominium.
Well, I'll tell you what. Basically, what happens, you know, you know how the game is played. It's simply set out to harass people. And anybody, of course, who speaks out against what's going on, of course, they're probably not going to kill you because you're too big a target. But they'll certainly make your life miserable to try to break down your will and spirit. But I don't think they're going to. I think that you're going to hang in there.
Well, that's not going to happen to me.
Ted Gunderson and I are going to be speaking at a conference here. Well, as soon as we get back, we'll tell you about it. But it's a conspiracy conference, and it's going to be the 27th and 28th of May, the Memorial Day weekend, up in Santa Clara. So we hope many of you will come to hear both Ted and I and John DeCamp and lots of other fascinating speakers. Ted, God bless you. Thanks so very much. Please keep in touch with me and let me know how things are going.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. Appreciate it.
Good night. Appreciate all your help. Bye-bye. All right, we'll be back in just a minute to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our program with Ted Gunderson. This is the second program we've done with him today. He's a very courageous guy. The story of Captain Jeffrey McDonald, sent to prison as an innocent man. He's been there for 25 years. You can type in the name up on the... and Google Jeffrey McDonald, Captain Jeffrey McDonald. You're not going to get the story you've just heard here, but at least you'll get the rest of the story. And, of course, he was the victim of a satanic cult. There are satanic cults out there. You need to get Gregory Reed's book, The Diary of a Devil Hunter Diary of a Devil Hunter, which we carry. We have 4-tape set on Satanism and Deliverance. We have 4-tape sets on Aleister Crowley. If you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to, and it's available on the book, DVD, or of course on certainly on video. And then to begin to get a perspective of the overall world revolution and why things are happening, and the ultimate goal, which is the establishment of a world government under the control of the Antichrist. Why, certainly you'd want to watch my video. It's entitled World Revolution. And it's really taken from a book written by James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, called Fire in the Minds of Men. In fact, the President Bush mentioned that phrase in his second inaugural address, the fire in the minds of men. It comes from a book by Dostoevsky about the world revolution called The Possessed. But you have to understand there's a continuing revolution. It began in 1776, and it continues till today. And it will continue until the whole world is under the control of the Antichrist or God intervenes. And so we're entering a very, very difficult time in our nation's history, and you need to understand it. And there's no better way than to listen to our programs regularly. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet. You can listen to our programs 4 hours a day on shortwave, and the shortwave frequencies are posted. And then if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call. Probably our February newsletter will give you the best insight into why we are going to war with Iran. And then, of course, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And if you'd like to get the Diary of a Devil Hunter, our 4-tape set on Satanism and Deliverance, our 4-tape set on Aleister Crowley, we carry a book on Aleister Crowley called Aleister Crowley and His Friends. There's some things in that I disagree with, but it's an excellent source of information on Crowley, and we have a little slip noting, why we would disagree with some of these statements' conclusions. But it's still the best book available. If you have not yet seen the videos, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, it goes into the background of the music industry and their dedication to a man named Aleister Crowley. And you'll see Aleister Crowley's face on the album put out by the Beatles and many of our other satanic groups. Oh, satanic, you say? Well, you really need to get the information. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Who did they sell it to? Why, they sold their souls to Satan. Just as many people in America have done. Please understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Thank you.